This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. First, Iran held a presidential election. Voters turned out in droves on June 12th after a campaign that energized young people and women in particular. Then the official result came, and millions of Iranians simply did not believe it. Again, they turned out in huge numbers to protest, to be met with riot police, shields, batons, and in some cases, gunfire. The story continued to spill out even after reporters were forced to leave when their visas expired. Despite government censorship, Twitter feeds buzzed with pictures and cell phone videos, including one that shocked the world, a young woman shot to death, drowning in blood on a Tehran street. The mass protests have since subsided, but important clerics and politicians continue to question the election, the government, and even the supreme leader. Some of the most passionate reports from Tehran came from Roger Cohen, a columnist for The New York Times and the International Herald Tribune, who overstayed his press pass to continue reporting from Iran. He's now back in the U.S. and joins us in a moment. After the election, after the protests, after the death of Neda circulated on every news outlet, what's changed in the way we engage with Iran? Should we reach out to the government or to the people? 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, Big Mother's watching, even when the kids go off to summer camp. But first, Roger Cohen joins us from his office at The New York Times, and it's very good of you to be with us today.
Hi, Neil.
And after what you saw in Iran, have your feelings changed about reaching out to the government?
They have, to some degree. I visited Iran in January, February, and I argued very strongly for engagement, partly on the basis of the very society that I think has become more apparent to many more Americans now. That is an overwhelmingly young and sophisticated and engaged population that thirsts for greater contact with the outside world. And I think it's very important and remains important to get beyond the caricatural image of Iran as a country of mad mullahs with one aim in mind, pursuing a nuclear bomb. That said, this government, in my view, of President Ahmadinejad going into a second term, is not a legitimate government. All the evidence I've seen points to substantial fraud in the election. And this process is ongoing. There's a lot of dissent within the regime, within the clerical establishment. There's acute political division. Millions of Iranians who were reluctantly acquiescent to the regime have moved into opposition. And I think this needs a couple of months at least to play out. And I think during that time, the Obama administration should in essence wait and see. So I think engagement, while not being abandoned as a longer-term goal, needs to be on hold for a moment.
Well, the Obama administration had to keep things on hold until the presidential election, until that clarified things, and now it needs to be put on hold again. When does policy get started?
Well, it didn't really have to be put it on hold until the election, Neil. It was simply that the Iranians did not come up to a response either to Obama's New Year message or to the subsequent invitation in April to join nuclear talks. I simply think that at this point, for Obama to say, okay, it's business as usual, if Ahmadinejad were to come forward and say, we'd like to begin the nuclear talks now, it would be an abandonment of the millions of Iranians who are indignant and still protesting this fraud. And it would say to the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, okay, we just respect the use of force. We accept what you've done, and we'll carry on. I think the president needs to signal through policy over the next 2-3 months American indignation and anger at what's happened.
You raise an important point about the supreme leader. The president of Iran is not the ultimate authority there. It's the supreme leader. And interestingly, immediately after the election results were declared, again, election results many people found difficult to believe, he declared that this was the divine justice, and we now know the results, and he's not swayed from that one little bit. If the government is illegitimate, is the supreme leader's position being challenged now?
I think the supreme leader's position has changed quite dramatically. In the setup put in place by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the leader of the 1979 revolution, this position really stood above the fray. The supreme leader was the arbiter of things in Iran and stood at the very side of the prophet. But Khamenei has factionalized himself. He's aligned himself very clearly with Ahmadinejad. And in his sermon a week after the election, he made it very clear exactly where he stood. And he made it clear that he was a chief mover in everything that has happened. This position is the keystone of the, excuse me, the keystone of the arch in the whole setup of the revolutionary regime. So I think that is a very substantial change going forward, and I think that to some degree has undermined the regime itself. What has also weakened it, I think, is that millions of young Iranians who were prepared to live with this setup because they believed that every 4 years in the presidential election, they didn't get a chance to change the supreme leader, but they got a chance to nudge the country in some new directions. That happened with the former reformist president, Mohammad Khatami, in 1997. And after what they viewed as mismanagement under Ahmadinejad and the needless deterioration in Iran's international reputation through some of the statements of Ahmadinejad, they thought they could do that again. It was an unbelievably freewheeling, vigorous, and vibrant election campaign. And then, boom, in the night of June 12 to June 13, everything changed. And we heard from rooftops, I heard in the couple of weeks after the election, the unthinkable. People were actually saying, Marg ba Khamenei, death to Khamenei. If for anybody who knows Iran and knows the stature of the supreme leadership and its importance within Islam, within the Shia branch of Islam, the supreme leader in effect is standing in for the Mahdi, the occulted 12th imam who disappeared in the 9th century, and believers think that he will return, and with his return will come justice and reconciliation on earth. Khamenei, as Khomeini before him, is within that belief, standing in for him. So to say that is, I think, one measure of how far things have shifted in Iran.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. Our guest, Roger Cohen, foreign affairs columnist for the International Herald Tribune and also a columnist for the New York Times, just recently back from 2 weeks in Iran. Let's go to Jamal. Jamal calling us from Berkeley in California.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very.
I actually arrived in Iran also on July 15th, and I just left on, I'm sure not July, June 15th, and I just got back July 4th. And I was probably in 70% of the demonstration, and I witnessed a brutal beating of not just students, but elderly, young people, anybody that had came out to see where their votes were not counted. And I do believe, I think the engagement should be with the people and definitely not with the government, because, and that's what the majority of the Iranian people I talk to, that's what they want. And also pressure on European Union to be tougher with Iran, and also UN to be tougher with Iran. And that's what I noticed. And I think the environment there was very charged, and they definitely want to change. And you see poster of Mousavi and change under it, and with the same type of slogan as Obama.
It's interesting, Jamal, as you know, and as I'm sure Roger Cohen knows as well, Mr. Mousavi is not regarded primarily as a radical, certainly not going into this election. All the candidates who were eligible to run were chosen by the Guardianship Council. Any real radicals would not have been allowed to run.
True, and I think and majority of people do see that, but they see it's a door that leads to another door, like Khatami led to Mousavi, and that will open another door and another door and another door. But I think they saw Ahmadinejad as a door going backwards. So that's what I think. I agree. They're both part of the same idea and philosophy, but he seems to be lesser of the two evils.
Lesser of the two evils, Roger Cohen, and well, Jamal brings up a point. And you brought it up, too, the passion that you saw in the streets of Tehran. This was not just students, as it was about 10 years ago. This was a wide range of Iranian people.
It was an extremely wide range, Neil. I was involved, present at many of the demonstrations, and there were shopkeepers alongside students. There were women of all ages. I saw people on crutches. I spoke to many people who'd been involved in the revolution in 1979. And there's no question this was a broad movement. You don't get 3 million people on the streets, and that's the official calculation of the mayor of Tehran, Khalibaf, who is not particularly a sympathizer with the opposition. You don't get 3 million people on the streets with a narrow movement or less than a very broad uprising against a perceived injustice. There's no question, and this is where I think really a historic opportunity was missed and a historic error made. Mousavi has impeccable revolutionary credentials. As you know, he was the prime minister during the Iran-Iraq war of the 1980s. And the Islamic Republic would certainly have survived. Indeed, I think it would have prospered to a much greater degree under his leadership, which would have, I think, reflected the desire of this overwhelmingly young population in Iran and of a majority of the people. And where I think President Obama really misspoke at one point was when he said, well, from the point of view of the U.S. national interest, it really makes no difference if Ahmadinejad or Mousavi is president. The fact is that Ahmadinejad is extremely volatile and you know, borderline hysterical figure at times, whereas Mousavi, who's not particularly charismatic, is very steady. And indeed, one of the things that ignited his campaign, along with the presence of his wife, was, I think, his very telling statements in the last 10 days of the campaign to the effect that Ahmadinejad had needlessly damaged Iran's reputation.
Roger Cohen is with us from New York. Thank you very much for the call, Jamal. 800-989-8255. Is it appropriate anymore to reach out to the government of Iran? This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Now back from Iran, Roger Cohen wrote in a column this week, I confess that out of Iran, I am bereft. I have been thinking about the responsibility of bearing witness. It can be singular still. Interconnection is not presence. A chunk of me is back in Tehran between Enqilab, revolution, and Azadi, freedom, where I saw the Iranian people rise in the millions to reclaim their votes and protest the violation of their constitution. The regime has been weakened by the flagrance of its lie, now only sustainable through force. No show trials can make truth of falseness. You cannot carve in rotten wood. Roger Cohen is foreign affairs columnist for the International Herald Tribune and a columnist with the New York Times. We posted links to several of his pieces that he filed from Tehran. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. So what's changed in the way the U.S. should engage with Iran? Should we reach out to the government or to the people? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And let's see if we can go to the next caller. And we'll go to William. William with us from San Jose.
Hi, this is William Beeman from the University of Minnesota. I really appreciated Roger Cohen's columns from Iran. And I wanted to point out that the current controversy in this election actually is an extremely old controversy in Iran. And it continues today as a theological discussion. This is one of the reasons why we see so much controversy among the mullahs in Iran. We have several groups of clerics out of Qom who are contesting this election because they don't accept the legitimacy, the basic legitimacy of the spiritual leader, Mr. Khamenei, and the basic principle of the regency of the jurisprudent in the face of the Mahdi. And I don't see that this is going to be resolved very soon. They're going to face a crisis very, very soon as Mr. Khamenei leaves office, either because he's voted out of office by the Assembly of Experts or because he dies. Because they don't have a successor, and I don't. I think that this is going to be an ongoing discussion for quite a long time in Iran about what the legitimate role of religion is with regard to the government.
Roger Cohen?
Yeah, I think Professor Beeman is right. Khamenei is only 69, so, and I saw him close up when he was voting, and he looked in pretty rude health. So I don't think his death is imminent. But I think, you know, if the question did somehow arise of how to replace him today, it would be almost impossible in the current climate to find a replacement. And certainly, the Islamic Republic has always suffered from the tension between those two words, Islamic Republic, the clerical values and the liberal values. And there was confusion during the revolution. Ayatollah Khomeini proved shrewder than the left-wing and liberal people who were involved in the revolution and outmaneuvered them. And the creation of this guardianship of the Islamic jurist, the Velayat Faqih, this system, emerged from that. And as I mentioned earlier, I think Khamenei has lost his aura, and that makes a position that was already fiercely contested even more vulnerable, which doesn't mean it's going to disappear overnight, but the question has certainly been raised, and it's foremost in many more Iranians' minds.
Can I add a footnote? Roger Cohen had a wonderful quote last Sunday from an informant on the street, who talked about the fact that the elections were only there to ratify the degree of public support for the Islamic Republic. And this is actually a talking point that could have come out of the Iranian Karl Rove kind of shop from somebody like Ayatollah Mohammad Taqi Mesbah Yazdi, who absolutely embodies this idea that there's no need for elections, that there's no need for any further kind of public referendum except to ratify what is already a perfect Islamic situation, as from his view. He's, by the way, the spiritual leader of President Ahmadinejad.
Thanks very much for the call, William. Appreciate it. Here's an email we have from Richard. There is much commentary about the aftermath of the elections. Is there any real evidence of the actual results? Just as curiosity, is it at all possible the announced results are true?
Well, you know, nobody's had access to the Interior Ministry. Look, the result was announced within 2 hours of the polling stations closing, supposedly enough of some 40 million handwritten votes had been counted in a couple of hours for Ahmadinejad's victory, with almost 63% of the vote to be announced. He got 5 million, just over 5 million votes in the first round in 2005, so he increased his votes, first round votes, by almost 20 million. Supposedly, this after a period of economic difficulty, rising unemployment and inflation, a great deal of accusations of mismanagement and corruption, a very heavily fought election campaign. The votes came out in clumps of 2 million to 5 million without any attribution to region. There was only a regional breakdown after about 10 days. One of the opposition candidates, Karoubi, who got almost 5 million votes, about the same as Ahmadinejad in the first round in 2005. His vote share went down to about 300,000, 0.8% of the vote, less than the spoiled ballots. There were too many ballots printed. The Guardian Council itself, which was asked to oversee the election, said there were some problems with perhaps 3 million votes, which is about 8% of the total, and in some 50 cities. The accumulation, Ahmadinejad's vote share, incidentally, also showed an almost perfect correlation across every region, whatever its ethnic or social makeup. The number never varied. The line just went straight up through the night. And everything I've seen just suggests that the number was more or less plucked out of the air and then reverse engineered backward to give the breakdown that was eventually given after about 10 days. And of course, reverse engineering of that kind take some time. The observers who were supposed to be present in polling stations from the Mousavi camp were, in most instances, denied access, and of course, communications were cut off immediately on that Friday night.
Yet you and the media from the rest of the world were invited to Iran to witness what was supposed to be this coronation, this great election. Why would they invite the media and then steal the election?
That is what suggests to me, Neil, that this, you know, even if there were surely contingency plans among the hardline coterie around Ahmadinejad, my sense was very much that this is a fairly calculating government and regime. If the revolution has survived, it's not by being capricious. And everything suggests to me that this was a last-minute decision, that it was taken in the last 72 hours. And we should remember that Mousavi was dead in the water 3 weeks before the election. I mean, there was nothing happening, nothing stirring. And then he connected, his wife connected. And moreover, they connected with a sea of green, which would have set every... I mean, one of the things I heard most in January, February was Velvet Revolution, Velvet Revolution. This must have set alarms going in all the minds of the Revolutionary Guards and the Basiji militia commanders. And I think the decision was taken pretty late to ram this through. And certainly, there was disarray afterward. You had Khamenei first saying, as you mentioned, that this was a miraculous result, which can be read many ways. Mm-hmm. Then referring it to the Guardian Council, saying, well, yes, perhaps we do need to recount. Then praising Ahmadinejad and urging him to be the president of all Iranians, irrespective of how they'd voted. And then Ahmadinejad responds to that by going out and making possibly the most divisive speech in political history, where he called everyone who hadn't voted for him a hooligan and no more significant than dust. So this was not a government proceeding smoothly with a plan that at least as I saw it, that had been set down weeks in advance. I think there was scrambling.
Now let's get Joseph on the line. Joseph calling us from Honolulu.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. Well, I understand everything that's been said, and I certainly agree with most of it. However, there are two points that should be brought in. One is that just before the election, ABC and the BBC did a poll which showed Ahmadinejad with a 2-1 landslide victory.
That was about 3 weeks before the election, yes.
Exactly. And the other point is that in 2008, Bush got up to $400 million from Congress in order to try to destabilize the government of Iran.
On the first point, I think Roger Cohen would say 3 weeks before the election was exactly when Mr. Mousavi started the wave rolling and connected with the Iranian people and opinion began to shift. And the second point goes, Roger Cohen, to the contention by the Iranian government, which is that there's been outside interference. And Joseph is right. The policy of the U.S. government has been, under the previous administration, regime change.
Yes, it has. It had been, incidentally, even that poll said the number of the one referred to there said that the number of undecided voters was so large that it could change the outcome. The second point being exactly yours, Neil, that this all ignited in the last 3 weeks. President Obama has reversed course on that, in the sense that he, in his Nowruz message, referred twice to the Islamic Republic of Iran, not a formulation that presidents had used before, and had offered to engage with his government. And my understanding is that any programs that had been activated with that funding have essentially been put on hold. I think the fact is, however, that we got a lot closer to regime change in 6 months of President Obama than had ever occurred in 8 years of President Bush. And I do think that engagement is in fact a form of pressure, or has proved a form of pressure. It's been unsettling to an Iranian government, which still pushes forward, you know, cries, however empty, of death to America at Friday prayers every Friday. And the question is there for the government, and it's still there, how to respond to these overtures, because the people of Iran are overwhelmingly pro-American. I would say probably 70 to 80% of Iranians are strongly pro-American. You have the opposite situation from Arab, many Arab societies, where you have a pro-U.S. government, like say in Egypt, and then a population that has at least been much more hostile. The situation's been reversed, is reversed in Iran, and that question remains on the table. You know, how are Khamenei and Ahmadinejad going to respond to this overture, which hasn't been withdrawn? It's sort of on hold, but it hasn't been withdrawn. And one theory, which I found quite persuasive, is that given some time, they might begin to respond positively to Obama, because it would be one way to begin to shore up some of the support that's been eroded by this whole fiasco of June 12th.
Joseph, thanks very much for the call. Our guest is Roger Cohen of the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And there is still the question, Roger Cohen, of Iran's nuclear ambitions, and no suggestion that the government is going to backtrack in any way on that. And given what you're saying is now an illegitimate government, which is in the hands of a president, and again, he's not the ultimate authority, that's the supreme leader, but nevertheless, President Ahmadinejad, who is volatile, what is Israel supposed to do now?
Well, you know, I think the case for engagement is still there. I mean, I say that with a heavy heart, but it is, because look at Iraq and our withdrawal from Iraq. Look at Afghanistan. Look at the situation in Lebanon, where Hezbollah is strong. Look at the prospects for any kind of Israeli-Palestinian peace, where Hamas, which again is under heavy Iranian influence, is going to have a say. Every problem across the Middle East, I think Iran is somewhat weaker right now than it was. It's been ascendant in recent years. I think that ascendancy is definitely on hold and maybe going to reverse, especially with declining oil. But it's still very hard to see resolutions of these issues without some kind of engagement with
Iran.
So
it sounds like what you're saying is decent interval. Let's wash the blood off the sidewalks and then engage.
That's a harsh way of putting it, Neil, but I still think however difficult, that I think bombing Iran, if Israel were to bomb Iran, try and bomb the nuclear facilities in Natanz and elsewhere, this would be an absolute disaster for the region. I think Iranians would unite, just as they united when Saddam Hussein, of infamous memory, invaded in 1980. You could see Hezbollah, Hamas moving into action. Iran has all kinds of surrogates. I think it would be an absolute disaster. And the only way to try to avert that, to try to reach some kind of settlement of the nuclear issue, is by talking to Iran. So I do think that, you know, in the end, there have to be talks of some kind. We have to look for talks. I don't know what Iranian government we're going to be dealing with. As I said at the beginning, this situation is volatile. For example, Ahmadinejad's not formed his government. Will there be an attempt to co-opt Mousavi or co-opt other opposition figures, a bit like what's happened in Zimbabwe, you know, as a way, again, of trying to shore up some support? Might it be determined at some point that Ahmadinejad is just too divisive a figure to survive? Very significant politicians in the conservative camp, like Ali Larijani, the speaker of the Majlis or parliament, or Mr. Khalibaf, the mayor of Tehran, they've both come out quite clearly against Ahmadinejad and saying the opposition has a case. The divisions in the clerical establishment are very extreme. So I don't know who we're going to be talking to, but I do think that at some point we've still got to try to talk to somebody.
Roger Cohen, thank you very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil.
And again, we have links to several of Roger Cohen's pieces from Tehran at our website at npr.org. And of course, he is a foreign affairs columnist for the International Herald Tribune and a columnist for the New York Times. And he joined us from his office in New York. Coming up, Big Mother is watching, even at summer camp. Streaming video, YouTube, text messages, whatever happened to the postcard home. Parents, where do you draw the line? Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.